This week's episode of the Autoblog Podcast is brought to you by the Autoblog Daily Digest. It's a great way to stay updated with what's happening in the world of cars in just 2 or 3 minutes every day. Ask your smart speaker for the Autoblog Daily Digest to stay up to speed with the latest car news, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. Joining me on the phones from mid-Ohio, not the mid-Ohio racetrack, but the middle of Ohio, it's consumer editor Jeremy Korsniewski. What's going on, man?
You know what? I'm enjoying the day. It's absolutely gorgeous out here in mid-Ohio, and we're actually not far from the mid-Ohio racetrack. I see signs for it all the time, but I haven't actually visited since I moved back to Ohio. I've been on the track a couple times for various events, but yeah, I think it's about an hour away from where I live. Wonderful track if you ever get a chance.
I would love to see an IndyCar race there. I've had a couple opportunities, but never actually taken advantage of them. Just never quite made it down. Such is life, I guess. We have a great show for you today. We're going to talk about the Volvo S90 Recharge. That's what I drove all of last week. Jeremy has some thoughts on the Lexus RX, why it is a very ideal suited luxury SUV for almost anyone. He's going to take you through that. So that's sort of the news or the reviews and features section, if you will. A couple other things. We're going to have some news subjects. The 2 Series was sort of previewed in some like official spy shots earlier this week. And then we're seeing rumors that the Land Cruiser, at least the one that goes on sale overseas, is going to get a downsized engine. We're just going to riff out the Land Cruiser. We'll go through a couple other feature items here, just spring beers, that sort of thing. I like how Jeremy put on the run sheet, I have a few. I don't know if you meant that you had a few or a couple of ideas, but we'll get into that. I had a very unconventional spring beer last night. I was preparing for this podcast, seriously. And what I wanted to drink wasn't chilled. Forgot to do it. So anyways, we have a mailbag and a spend my money. So just right off the top, send us your spend my monies, send us your questions, send us your just takes on the show or, you know, what's going on in the car business. That's podcast@autoblog.com. We want to know what you think. But I'm going to dive right into the Volvo S90. I spent a fair amount of time in it. I didn't charge it. It comes with a portable charger, which is good. But you only get 21 miles out of it. And I basically drained it. And then just, it's, you know, very strong T8 powertrain, as they call it. Just didn't quite have a chance to charge it. I should have. I freely admit that, but I didn't. But I really like the whole like sort of portable charge setup, especially when you're in like you're testing a car. You can just plug in the charger in your garage and away you go. 21 miles is, I think, pretty usable. You know, it'll get you almost wherever you want to go in a short stint. It's not something you could, you know, even for a long commute that's going to work. But you know, It's fine for just like, hey, I want to be charged to go to the grocery store or go to restaurants or things like that. That sort of thing. Plenty of low-end torque. It's a quick car. It's basically Volvo's flagship sedan at this point. The S90 is, I think, beautiful inside and out. They've kept it updated. You know, if you look at, you know, even just some of the lighting features, they've really kept them, you know, in keeping with like some of the things Mercedes and Audi and BMW have done, you know. But what I like about Volvo, not just like the hybrid here, the plug-in hybrid, you know, execution, which I think is good, but it's the timeless design, inside and out. You know, they really, I would say they won me over, if you will, as far as just keeping this car contemporary. But still, you know, it looks good. People looked at it. It was great, you know. So yeah, I enjoyed it. Have you driven an S90 in a while, Jeremy?
No, I haven't. And I was actually just looking at Volvo's lineup. So if I'm seeing this correctly, they don't do a recharge of the wagon version. The what is it called? The V90 Cross Country or the V90 wagon. Which they do have, but as far as the plug-in hybrid version, it's sedan only. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's how I understand it. And the plug-in hybrid does give you 400 horsepower. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Total system output.
Yeah, I mean, my commentary on that is it's always frustrating to me when and it totally makes sense for them to do this, for them to offer their big sellers in the, you know, the most diverse versions. But I mean, how difficult would it be for them to drop that plug-in hybrid into, or, you know, powertrain into the wagon? If they're going to offer it in the sedan, I would think that that would mean that the powertrain is already certified. I wouldn't expect that they'd have to like redo crash testing or anything else like that. I mean, I guess just convincing dealerships to put in orders for them, because from what I've heard, it's next to impossible to find a regular Volvo wagon, not a cross country, but a regular Volvo wagon on a dealership lot anyway. But I mean, for that, you know, for that, in that case, they may as well offer a V90 cross country in the plug-in hybrid, you know, being that that's one of the more popular vehicles.
Yeah, that's true. I think they, you know, there's parts of Volvo's like strategy that I don't quite get, like why they're doing things a certain way. Like, I believe the V90 wagon, just the wagon, is like special order, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, I guess I can't argue with that. Like, if you want it, you can get it, but you've got to like special order it. That's fine. But yeah, I think it would make sense to maybe like, you know, proliferate this, you know, hybrid tech across a few more of the 90s. Especially because to me, the sedan is, you know, I get that they maybe want to really make this like flagship, almost like their version of the S-Class. But, you know, I mean, this is just good technology. That's where the industry is going. You might as well use it more often.
I didn't look up sales numbers, but I would bet that the cross country probably outsells the regular S90.
So same. It's kind of, I would think so too.
It's kind of curious that they don't put the recharge in. I mean, maybe they're constrained on how many they can actually produce. That would be a viable reason for them to, you know, start with one. And but yeah, that would be the killer app to me, for them to offer the V90 wagon. But if not the V90 wagon, at least the cross country with that recharge. I mean, can you think of how like just smart that vehicle would be? Like, it's not nearly as inefficient because it sits lower to the ground. It's more aerodynamic than a crossover or an SUV, but it's got all the luggage space in the world. It's got 400 horsepower, all wheel drive. And now, you know, you plug in and benefit from the efficiency improvements of the powertrain. And you're going to get most people will get a tax rebate as well, because of the size of the battery pack. So, not to go on a tangent, that sounds perfect to me. I wish Volvo would offer it that way, but I've driven the plug-in hybrid powertrain in other vehicles. I've not driven an S90 recharge yet. It's very intriguing. I love the idea of adding electric motors, getting that instant boost of torque. I bet that car feels pretty darn quick, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, large sedans, I think, can either feel just like limousines or hearses, or they can actually feel surprisingly quick. This one, I think, falls into the latter. It's plenty of power. Like I said, 400 total system horsepower is pretty good.
Yeah, I'm a little curious about the long-term reliability of Volvo's twin charge engine lineup.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. It's very complicated.
Yeah, supercharged and turbocharged, and in this case, also buoyed by electric motors. So, I mean, there is a lot going on is a really nice way of putting that.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, your discussion about why don't they use this powertrain in, like, the wagons. They do it in the XC90, though, which is obviously by far the volume model.
Right.
And that's probably, of all of these, the vehicle I've spent the most time in, actually. Like, I drove the S90 as much as I needed to get a good flair for it. I love driving it. It's a beautiful car that's fun to drive. But I just spent a lot of time in previous tests the XC90 with the T8 hybrid. So it's like, you know, you can see how it works. I remember there's like a little bit of a wonky, like something goes on with the transmission was something that stuck with me in the XC90 hybrid, where it was kind of like, huh, that's kind of weird. You know, like just there's so much going on there with all the twin charges. Like there's literally everywhere you go through the rev band, there's like a part of the engine is trying to do something, you know, and that's maybe overkill a little bit. I don't know.
I mean, there's just, imagine the amount of tuning that would have to go into getting the electronics just right. And not even just the electronics, but shift points and, you know, the systems have really got to be talking to each other. It almost makes you think things will be so much more simple for the engineers once everything is just fully electric.
Yeah.
You know, there's still, not to take away from the engineering required of, you know, to make a proper electric car. But, you know, at least you're not dealing with these disparate sources of motive power going to all the different wheels through different transmissions and sets of gears and planetary gear sets and all that. I mean, even like the most common hybrid in the world, the Prius, even that sometimes has a little bit of funkiness going on with the, you know, you're driving down the highway and you give it a little bit of gas and you think you're going to get a boost from the electric motor, but the battery power is not quite there. So the engine revs up instead. You know, it's mostly seamless, but there's just the words that you used, a lot going on in these hybrid drivetrains. The other word you used that I wholeheartedly agree with is timeless. You know, looking past the powertrain and the uniqueness of it, Volvo's designs, both inside and out, really are timeless. And they have been for like two decades now. We put together these used car spotlights. So I've been looking at a lot of used car ads and, you know, a 15-year-old S60 or XC60 is still just an extremely good looking car. They've been like slowly refining this basic shape and style that they've got going on right now. And each generation is just a little bit, you know, more smoothed out or a little bit more muscular than the ones before. And they're doing a lot with the Thor's hammer headlights. And, you know, it's not that they're not improving, but even the ones that are a previous generation at this point, you still see that car drive down the road and it looks like it could have rolled off a showroom floor. Like it's timeless. Timeless is in automotive terms is a couple generations, right? But good on Volvo for hitting that really cool stylistic trend.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think too that if you look at some of the things that like Mercedes and Audi in particular are doing, their cars are getting really busy. I like how just simple and clean Volvo's sedans and crossovers are. They're just, you know, the lines are in the right places. And then you do the headlights and you get the interiors right with the nice materials. I mean, crystal shifters, hey, that's cool.
Yeah, why not?
You know, so that works for me. You know, it's definitely, in a way, it's almost like what Audi used to be, you know, Audi used to be this way. And then they've really, in the last probably 5, 6, 7 years, started to like bust out the extra crayons and pencils for their designers. And, you know, personally, I prefer this look.
Yeah, I prefer the Volvo look. I often I remember the first time as a journalist, I had a Audi A7, the first generation Audi A7 dropped off. And I just remember just walking around the car inside and out, opening up the doors, looking at it from all the angles and thinking, this is just an absolutely beautiful vehicle. And I still see that car like drive by in the road. And I don't think that they've honestly improved on it in subsequent generations and iterations and refreshes and whatnot. Just that original A7 to me is kind of Audi's styling high mark.
Yeah. No, that's, it's funny how things like that stay with you and sort of like resonate, you know, that timeless element, I guess, if you will.
Right.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So here's a segue to the Lexus RX
Please.
Lexus does not do this timeless styling thing. They are really kind of like, they're one of the, on the forefront of the avant-garde, you know, kind of new wave styling. I think Audi maybe started the trend by putting big grills on their cars before anyone else really started doing it. But I don't think anyone, I mean, okay, not anymore. BMW takes the cake in controversial styling now. But for a long time, I think it was Lexus with their spindle grille. You know, like it works on some vehicles, but the bigger the vehicle gets, the less it works, I think. Like you look at an LC and that spindle, especially in the metal finish, just works. It's beautiful. I think it works on the NX or the UX, the NX and the RX. But you get bigger than that, you get to a GX, you get to the LX, the big old Land Cruiser, the Lexus Land Cruiser, and it starts to look like a caricature where they're just like, it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I see it and I always think the Predator movie, it's kind of got those like funky sideways mandibles, but I digress. I started talking about the Lexus RX and here's the genesis of this thought. We have been, you know, if you look at Autoblog Daily, you'll see that we've started adding best lists to our content coverage. We've got best SUVs of all different shapes and sizes, and the one of the more recent ones we did is the best premium crossovers and SUVs. And the way we come up with these lists is, you know, a little look behind the scenes. We create a list of all of them electronically, and all of the editors, people who drive these cars day in and day out, we go in and we mark which ones we think should be nominated. And then from that list, we whittle it down to our absolute favorites. And I noticed that the last go round of premium crossovers and SUVs, I was the only person to put a check mark next to the Lexus RX. And I was a little surprised by that. I guess surprised isn't the word, but it made me start thinking of like in defense of the Lexus RX, like thought. So I'm just going to, you know, muse about this for a little bit on the podcast. The RX, I think, is almost the perfect premium branded vehicle for more buyers than probably anything else. All the check marks that people say that they're looking for when they buy a vehicle are met. The reliability, resale value, premium nameplate, the performance is there. I mean, it's got plenty of power, and it's super quiet. It rides extremely well. The only demerit that we as journalists and enthusiasts tend to give the Lexus RX is that it's not sporty, even when you add the F Sport package to it, which makes it look sporty. It doesn't really do much for the actual driving dynamics of the car. And you see them everywhere. They're very, very popular. And I think there's like a natural tendency to kind of overlook the most popular one and say like, okay, well, we already know that one's, you know, extremely popular. What else should you take a look at? And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, being a little bit contrarian can be, you know, really interesting and add spice to life. You know, and if you really love your cars, you don't really want to see yourself coming and going all the time necessarily. So I get why an enthusiast, someone who you know, just looks forward to their morning commute, might overlook it. For everyone else, which, let's be fair, is the vast majority of people, it's pretty much ideal. And I think that that works both as a brand new vehicle for people who are shopping with 0 miles to be the first owner. And I think it also makes a lot of sense in the lightly used market too. For instance, if you've been watching car pricing lately, you'll see that, you know, even something like, you know, a Ford Edge or a Nissan Murano or something like that, you add, you know, the nice leather interior, the really nice trim, the wheels that you want, all that kind of stuff. And they get really expensive. You know, mid to high 40s is pretty common for even a non-premium branded crossover today, like a personal crossover. That, I think a lot of buyers who are looking for something like that would really do well to look at a lightly used 2 to 3 year old version of the current Lexus RX. It is a more premium product. It is the most solidly screwed together thing that you're going to drive. And I think the trustworthiness of Lexus and parent company Toyota's powertrains, you're not going to have a problem if this thing's got 35,000 miles on it. The likelihood of you having a major repair in your ownership time is extremely low, probably even lower than if you put that, you know, Nissan, brand new Nissan Murano in your driveway instead. So yeah, basically that's a long-winded way of saying, let's not overlook the Lexus RX. It's popular for a reason. And I think it deserves more praise than it gets.
Well said. I would say there's two things about Lexus SUVs that stand out for me. One is their styling. And I do think, you know, we've thrown around the phrase like timeless styling on this podcast a few different ways now. Is it timeless? Probably not. But does it look good? I think it does. I think their risk taking has paid off. And it's definitely a look that if you don't like it, don't get it, you know?
Right, right.
And to your point, they sell so many of them. You know, we like, as car journalists, we like to say, oh, it's polarizing. Well, if it is, a lot of people sure seem to buy them and like them, you know?
That's right.
So, you know, in a design vacuum, yeah, it's more aggressive than, you know, many different brands, like Volvo, for example. Mm-hmm. But, to be honest, though, look at the feel. Look at Genesis. Look at like BMW, which we're going to talk about here in a second. Who isn't going aggressive? You know,
right,
who
right.
isn't taking risks? And many Lexus SUVs, from the UX, which I believe you can get as a hybrid, mm-hmm. to the GX, to even the RX, they're okay to drive. Like mm-hmm. the steering, I feel like Lexus does a little bit more with its steering because they've tried to make their cars this, like, you know, with the 5 liter naturally aspirated V8, mm-hmm. they do want to have that like sporting aura. And I think they at least try to transfer some of that over to some of the SUVs. Mm-hmm. And even that means there's maybe a little bit of artificial, like, you know, tuning and such.
Yeah.
Sure. Whatever. Fine. I don't care. I like it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Diet Coke is good. You know,
I think it's pretty likable. And you know, just backing this up, I have suggested both routes to friends of mine in recent years. I have a friend who bought a brand new RX 350, absolutely loves it, best car they've ever owned, according to them. And I've got another set of friends, some of our very best friends, were shopping for a new vehicle. And I recommended the slightly used RX instead of the, you know, the new, more mainstream car. And their ex Ford Edge, well, they current Ford Edge owners, but a very old one, that they bought, you know, years and years ago. It's got 150,000 miles on it now. But I suggested they take a look at the RX 350, among other options. I gave them other options. And the RX is what they ended up with. And again, they absolutely love the thing. I just think it's a really, really attractive option for a huge segment of the buying population.
It's interesting too, because some people, once they reach a certain age or state, they don't really want to buy used cars anymore. They'd rather lease. Mm-hmm. I can understand that line of thinking, but like a lightly used, especially if it's still like CPO, mm-hmm. like 2 or 3 year old used car, like a Lexus, which is a quality vehicle,
right,
is in many ways better than like stepping down a segment. You know, like get the Lexus RX. You may keep it for 7, 8, 9, 10 years. That's a great buy for you. You know,
right.
You think, you know, about the long game, you know, and you're driving a nicer car.
You're driving a nicer car and you lopped, you know, $10,000, maybe even $15,000 off the initial purchase price. And it still feels like a new vehicle. At that point, and one that you're probably going to enjoy living with for you know, several years more than if you'd have bought a less expensive brand new option.
Well said. Any other Lexus RX thoughts?
No. That concludes my defense of the Lexus RX.
I like it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who are going to be listening to this podcast are definitely going to agree that the RX is great. Again, the genesis of this thought process started just because, you know, I think it's overlooked by enthusiasts, and I think that's fine. You know, the Porsche Macan and several other vehicles, mm-hmm. they really are good driver's vehicles. And you know, there's any number of options that, you know, you might be a little bit more fun on a twisty road, but that is just not, that's not a huge, like, buying motivation for a lot of people.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think overlooked by enthusiasts. That's a segment we could explore further on the podcast and maybe on the site.
That's an interesting one. Yeah, I like it.
You know what's not overlooked by enthusiasts? BMW
that,
coupes. How about like the 2 Series?
I love it.
A lot going on there. We had a kind of a teaser post this week went up. One of those like official spy photos, like they released the camo car, blah, blah, blah. But good things so far. We're hearing all-wheel drive, straight 6, 382 horsepower. You know, pretty good looking shots even in the car, you know, camo, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, I think we'll probably also again have like, you know, naturally rear wheel drive will be part of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is like, everybody likes to talk about two-door BMWs and that what comes up like immediately is the 2002, like mm-hmm. what's the real successor to it? And for a while, kind of like kicking the 2 Series was a bit of a sport among automotive journalists. You know, we're like, you know, this ain't it. You know, this isn't really the successor. You know, people were like waxing poetic about the 1 Series M, which was literally like 1 or 2 model years of existence, like back in 11, 12, 13, somewhere in there. They were all like bright orange. But this sounds like something you could sign me up for. I think this is the right direction. I feel like BMW is, you know, getting a lot of the like the foundational elements correct here. And I'll just throw it out there. I think the large grill looks good on the smaller cars. I would assume this thing's going to get a big grill. Although it's funny, the camo shots kind of cover it up in a way that looks pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a car I'm excited to drive. I pay a lot of attention to like BMW 2-doors. I like the 4 Series. I'm probably in a smaller group there. A lot of people don't like it. They think it's not what a BMW coupe should be, that it's too big, or just the dynamics aren't where they should be. But I like that car. So, I don't know. I'm feeling cautiously optimistic about this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's something like a 4 Series is, I mean, it's an excellent car. There's very little, you might not like the styling, which I can understand, but get behind the wheel and drive it. It's, you know, pretty much superior to anything else that you're going to compare it with. So I don't think you're off base with that. The 2 is an interesting one. Now, if you're listening to this, you should bear in mind that there's kind of a fork in BMW's 2 Series range. They've got a front wheel drive based platform on some versions of the 2, like the, what is it, the Grand Coupe? Is that what?
Yeah.
So that's not what Greg's talking about here. He's talking about what will be known as the 230i and M240i. Don't know what the 230i is going to be powered by. Probably a turbocharged 2-liter four cylinder. The 240i is M240i is the really interesting one here. That's the turbocharged 3-liter inline six. They have already said it's going to be 382 horsepower, which is 47 horsepower more than the current M240. And even that one, I've driven it. It feels very powerful. So this is going to be even better. And it is going to be xDrive all-wheel drive, but BMW does a better job than most making their all-wheel drive vehicles still feel like rear-wheel drive. They started that with the M5, I took the it's not the refreshed one now, but a few years back I took that M5 all-wheel drive on a racetrack in Portugal, and I can tell you it very much has the dynamics of a rear-wheel drive vehicle. So I expect the same out of this new M240i, and I expect it to be just an excellent driver's car. The M2 is also excellent. We don't know exactly what's going to happen with that, but I suspect that if they're you know, redoing the 230i and M240i, that they will also do the same with the M2. And I look forward to finding out what the deal with that's going to be.
Which track in Portugal did you take the M5 on?
It was Portimão, if I'm remembering correct. I don't think it was, what's the other one? Estoril?
Algarve.
Yeah. Circuit de Algarve. I'd have to look it up again, but I'll tell you, it was a great experience.
I took, an E63 on Portimão. Geez, probably winter of 16, fall of 16, like somewhere in there. Man, that was pretty awesome. It was a great track.
Portugal really is a great place. Country. Portugal is just, I love visiting Portugal, and anytime it includes a little bit of racetrack, can't be mad about that.
I remember as I entered the final curve, rain started coming down. I was like, nice. Just like right as I was completing my last lap. And I had, I may be mixing some of these trips up because there was another trip with an Audi TTRS in that same time frame, but I believe that was actually in Spain. But I remember there was a professional race car guy behind me on the Mercedes trip, I think. And I remember thinking, I just got to stay ahead of this guy. And they like staggered it out. So like even a professional would have a tough time running you down just like for safety's sake. But I was still like, I mean, let's be real. There is that much of a gap between me and like a guy who races like ALMS or, you know, IMSA, whatever it was at the time. But yeah, great memories. Let's kind of do a hard fade over to the Land Cruiser.
Yes, sir.
There's some rumors that the new one, that will go on sale globally, but we still don't know when exactly it's going to like return here. I'm not actually sure they've even confirmed it's going to return here. It's technically not gone yet. They're sort of selling down the current gen. They sold, let's see, almost 1,900 of them. I just threw that in the run sheet here through Q1. So they're still selling them. Like if you want one, you could probably still get one. Or get a used one from the last 5 years. It's not that different, really, even farther back than that. We don't know if this means they're going to look at downsizing the engine if when it comes back. It's a 3.5-liter V6, I believe, twin turbo. I don't know. This is kind of a chance to riff on the Land Cruiser.
Yeah,
I would probably prefer to get it in a V8 just because Land Cruiser. That said, I think a good parallel is the Navigator, the Lincoln Navigator. They took away that ancient V8 that was in there, like the old Ford F-150 truck engine, and put the EcoBoost V6, and that was way better. I mean, it was more powerful. It was a better driving experience. So, tradition aside, it's probably the right move.
Yeah, Land Cruiser is a funny one, though. Looking back at Land Cruiser history, every time there is a major redesign, there's an uproar from fans of the current version.
Yeah.
It happened. I think, you know, everyone thinks back on the old 4.5 liter inline six is kind of being, at least here in the United States. I mean, if you look at Australia and South America and, you know, other places, the Land Cruiser legacy is very storied and set in stone. Here in the States, you know, we don't quite have the outback conditions that, you know, people buy a Land Cruiser because they're like, you know, I need this thing to be dead reliable. And if it isn't, I might die out somewhere. We don't really have that kind of thing so much in the United States. I mean, there's some deserts out there, but you're never too far from a cell signal, put it that way. So here in the States, I think that the 4.5 liter inline six, that generation, and I can't, that's not the 100 series, is it? Was that 80 series maybe? I can't even remember anymore. Too much stuff floating around in my head. But yeah, that inline six, that was just known around the world as a bulletproof engine, as bulletproof as engines can be. And then they replaced it with a 4.7 liter V8. I think that is the 100 series, and that here in the United States just, you know, absolutely cemented rock solid the Land Cruiser as, you know, basically the most durable thing that you can buy. That engine is just absolutely without peer when it comes to reliability. I do think that they are maybe timing belts that need to be replaced every 100,000 miles, something like that. But I mean, past that, those things just don't die. And when they switched over to the 5.7 liter, which is borrowed from the Toyota Tundra range, there was again an uproar. And the 5.7 has also proven to be great. It doesn't quite have the reputation that the older 4.7 had, or even the 4.5 inline six. But again, it's top shelf, extremely reliable, excellent power plant. So I think before we, you know, raise our pitchforks, we should recognize that Toyota knows what they're doing, and they do not want to mess up the legacy of the Land Cruiser either. So if they do go with a new twin turbo 3.5 liter V6, like rumors seem to indicate that they will, let's give it some time and see if this new power plant is going to live up to the reputation of past Land Cruisers. And I am, however, going to add a caveat. I think one of the reasons why the 5.7 maybe isn't quite as it doesn't quite have the reputation of the old 4.7 is because to keep up with modern expectations and emissions requirements and everything else, they've got to keep adding technology to these things. You know, variable valve timing and you know camshafts that shift their positioning and more electronic, you know, processing power than, you know, your first PC probably had. And every time they add complexity like that, it's another potential breaking point. Adding turbochargers. I mean, turbochargers at this point are a known quantity, not something that is going to break all the time. But, you know, it does add heat and there's a lot of electric components that are under there. So I get where people are, you know, going to be concerned about it. And I share those concerns, but I also, you know, Toyota is pretty trustworthy when it comes to not messing up the Land Cruiser and not letting down those diehard fans. So, I guess I'm not too worried about it. And for people whose lives do depend on the vehicle not breaking down, they still sell old versions of the Land Cruiser in Australia and several other countries that they're not here in the States, but, you know, we don't, like I said earlier, we don't really need that level of reliability.
For my own part here, I think there's a big opportunity in this large, like premium, really, it's like almost like a luxury SUV segment from mainstream manufacturers, whether it's the Suburban and the Tahoe to, you know, just large SUVs like the Expedition, the Explorer, things like that. a little bit of GMC thrown in there. But, you know, I mean, there's a spot for them. You can make a ton of money off of them. I think there's a segment of people that would rather have a Suburban than an Escalade. They would rather have a Land Cruiser than a Lexus or like a BMW X7 or, you know, down the line. They want these rough and tough vehicles. I mean, frankly, that's why you're seeing like the Grand Wagoneer and the, you know, just things like that. You know, even the Grand Cherokee is getting a three-row item, you know. So it's like there is, you know, like I said, a lot of opportunity. I like this current generation. I mean, I think the Land Cruiser just, it's the right look. You know, I think it's obvious what it is. And that to me is prestigious in and of itself. You know, get inside one and you're like, oh my goodness, you know, like the steering's a little all over the place. Like, let me put it this way. It's like the one car that makes driving like a Wrangler or a 4Runner seem like modern and relatively easy. You know, drive a Land Cruiser. And that's a bit of a workout, but it's, you know, I think it's a great thing. So, it'll be interesting to see what the modern application is when they bring it back here. Maybe it'll be all electric. I don't know. Now I'm just like, you know, spitballing.
You know, I do think that, again, rumors indicate, because here in the States, there's a Lexus version as well. There was the LX450. That was the inline six. There was the LX470, which was the 4.7 V8, and there's the LX570, which is currently on sale now. And they've always shared powertrains, but the more recent rumors suggest that Lexus and Toyota may go different directions with this. The Toyota may get the twin turbo six and Lexus the LX, which is much more likely to continue sales in America. It's very popular and extremely profitable. That still might get the V8. So we'll see. Maybe there'll be an option for American buyers if things go their way.
It's funny when we talk about these, like, you know, I think the term iconic does apply to, you know, definitely the Toyota and maybe even the Lexus version. I mean, literally we're waiting and at like a few minutes, we're gonna hear about this electric F-150. You know, there's news about how the Hummer weighs 9,000 pounds. All these like pivots to electricity every day. It's like, what's the big Tesla story? But we're still sitting here talking about how, like, you know, this large Lexus SUV is going to get a big old V8, probably. I do think there's an interesting near-term strategy for automakers. And I mean very near-term, like 5 years. Afterwards, I think you're going to have to be like, what do we do with this? We got to do a more dramatic shift with some of these existing internal combustion engines. And just how are we going to compete in these spaces? Like, is our large full-size off-road SUV going to be electric? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, my guess is vehicles like this are going to, I mean, it is a sea change. It's like, are you going to use the Land Cruiser name and make it all electric and make it the special electric Land Cruiser? Or is it going to be the other way in just like 7-8 years, the Land Cruiser's electric? You know, I can see it like the technology kind of catching up to the nameplate, you know? So we'll see.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because it's an interesting time to be a follower of the automotive industry, because Ford's going to show off the day that we're recording this. It's Tuesday. Ford's going to show off the new Lightning electric pickup, and by the time you're listening to this, maybe the debut has already happened. But what's not going to be mentioned when they show off the shiny brand new electric pickup truck is that they also sell versions of their F-Series truck with 5-liter V8s. And, you know, another F-Series has such a big V8 engine that they refer to it as Godzilla. You know, let's not overlook the fact that, you know, for every million F-150s powered by gasoline that Ford is going to sell here in the United States over the next several years, for every million of those that are, you know, not getting great gas mileage, they're probably going to sell, you know, a dozen of these electric Lightnings. You know, those numbers are maybe off by a little bit, but I mean, the ratio is going to be drastic. And the bigger these vehicles get, Greg mentioned the 9,000 something pound Hummer EV. we were doing some math earlier in the in our communication just internally, and someone mentioned, and I didn't check this number, but someone mentioned that the battery pack for the Hummer EV is going to be 213 kilowatt hours.
Whoa.
That is just a massive battery pack. Like, I feel like if you were to drop that battery pack in the middle of my block, we could probably, run the entire block's energy needs for a week with that battery pack. That's the equivalent of something like 4 or 5 Nissan Leafs. Not to go too crazy into these into the weeds on these discussions, but with these new off-road oriented electric vehicles that are coming out, I'm super excited for them. But over the coming years, I think the mining of lithium and recycling of these battery packs, and what do you do them at the end of their life cycle? Do you use them to power, solar generation systems? Do you, try to break them down and reuse the materials? That's going to be a very interesting story to watch. And especially if they start adding, Toyota's been putting hybrids on everything, but they put them on something popular like, a Land Cruiser that's sold worldwide. And the bigger the vehicle, the bigger the battery pack. So like, is it going to be 10 times the size of the pack in the Prius? Who knows what's going to happen? Like I said, when I started this little soliloquy, it's a very interesting time to be monitoring the automotive segment.
I kind of wonder if, like, this is, the Hummer is one of General Motors. It's not the first, but it's among the early, really large, electric SUVs, and part of, by extension, like SUVs and then trucks they're working on. Part of me wonders if by doing, having the Hummer first, it's okay to make it weigh 9,000 pounds. Like, you couldn't make the Bolt EUV weigh that much, but it's like, well, hey, we have all these batteries, we don't have all the range. It'd be okay if it weighs this much first, and then, we'll figure out ways to maybe streamline things, or, and this, it should be mentioned, I believe this is the most expensive and capable version of the GMC Hummer that weighs that much. Like, the ones that have shorter range aren't going to be quite this, quite this heavy. So, but we should probably transition to a heavy topic. What are you drinking these days? We haven't done a beer podcast in a while, and I didn't want to let spring go by without at least doing a little bit of a spring beer segment, because we're about 3 or 4 weeks away from summer. So what's your spring beers?
Okay, so I've got a can. Don't worry, it's empty, pre-drank.
I'm not judging. It's work from home Tuesday.
This is a Rogue, so very large brewery that everybody knows and anybody can get near them. It's Honey Kolsch.
Okay.
Excellent. Kolsch style ale brewed with wildflower honey. Mm-hmm. 5% ABV. I don't know if you drink a lot of Kolsches, Greg, but they tend to have like a little bit of a little bit of a weediness to them. Mm-hmm. Almost like a little bit of a pepperiness too, that I think is really refreshing. Low ABV, only 5%. And 26 IBUs, so not overly hoppy. Add just a touch of honey, and you get a little bit of sweetness that turns it into an excellent spring beer. So that is my spring beer pick of the podcast.
Nice. Looks pretty tasty. I will give you 2 or 3. I like to start out spring with a Guinness, just because it's still usually pretty cold out. Heavy beer. It's good, March, it's St. Patrick's Day, obviously. It's just kind of like the right beer, especially if you're having maybe like a cookout, you're grilling and it's a little chilly out. You don't mind having a little bit of a heavier beer. Pours nice into a glass and, especially, like I said, if it's snowing out even, which is not uncommon here, hey, your beer stays cold. So that's more like my March beer. Mm-hmm. Then I like to transition into an Oberon in April, I think, is good. That's a Bell's beer, which I think is, it's a little light. Well, it's not lighter. It's a little more kind of orangey, fruitier. Mm-hmm.
Weedy.
Good beer. Weedy. Yeah, good one. Or I like to do Bell's Two Hearted Ale, which is a bit of a stronger IPA, but it's a good one. You only need a couple of those. They oftentimes come in like larger cans, almost like pint cans. It's a pretty good beer. I think that's a good mid-spring beer. And then honestly, this time when it's like sort of the third part of, you know, spring, you're closing on summer, it's hot, you're probably cutting the grass. I'm willing to go straight up like Blue Light, Rolling Rock, you name it, lawnmower beer.
Lawnmower beer.
It's like, it's usually pretty hot out. And last night I did flip the script. I was grilling chicken and I made a tactical error. I was kind of looking forward to like a Monday Heineken, you know, maybe not my normal spring beer, but whatever, it's beer, you know, it's fine. Forgot to chill them. So I'm going through the fridge, and at this point, the grill is lit. The chicken is on, getting close to needing to flip the chicken. All I have is, guess what? Guinness. All right, whatever. It wasn't blisteringly hot. It was pretty good, you know?
So your beer emergency was solved by a cold can of Guinness.
It was a bottle, actually.
A cold bottle of Guinness.
Poured it into a pint glass, and it's actually quite good. I had no regrets. I was like, hey, this is fine.
Yeah, you know, going into winters, I go pretty heavy into dark beers. Coming out of winter when it's still cold, but you know, there's like some good weather coming up on the horizon. I switched to like nut browns. You know, I drink an amber every once in a while, but since you came out with so many more than I did, I'll mention one more. My Polish heritage, anyone who sees the site, looks at my last name, immediately knows that I'm Polish. There's some good Polish beers out there. I've got one in my fridge right now, Zywiec, Z-Y-W-I-E-C-K or something like that. I don't remember exactly how, but I see them around at specialty beer shops. I've never not been able to find them. And the one that I get is, I believe it's a porter. But it's very strong and it comes in a big bottle. So it's, you know, pop it open and share it with a friend. I think it's like 9%, something like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but it's excellent. You know, I feel like I'm reconnecting with some ancestry there every time I pop one open.
I am a big fan of amber ales. For me, that's like sort of going into like the winter months where the days are short and, you know, maybe you want to have like a heavier beer. The amber ale is like a perfect September, October, November kind of beer. Like I'll literally go from like autumn ales to amber ales to, you know, get it even, you know, like, you know, you go from red to kind of like, you know, just the darker hued beers and they taste really good. It's great. You know, as the leaves change, have a tailgate. That's really my favorite time of the year for beer, you know, just to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, all times of the year are pretty good for beer if you, you know. Going into summer, you know, there's a big mix of people with what they like in their IPAs. I like all IPAs. I mean, I don't like things that are.
Are you a session IPA guy? Just curious.
I love session IPAs. Like on like if you're gonna be if you know you're cracking one open and it's gonna you're gonna have like three more.
Yeah.
A session IPA like a you know Founders All Day something like that makes a lot of sense. If you're, you know, I mean, you're going to the river or the beach or something like that. Session IPA is great for that. I've gotten into hazy IPAs and New England IPAs lately. And I know there's a lot of people who, you know, kind of don't like them because they're, you know, non-traditional. To that I say, whatever, don't drink them then. But I welcome them. I think they're great. I drink a lot of Haze Jude, which is from a Platform here in Ohio.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of that one.
It's excellent. Yeah, I think they're based out of Cleveland, but they've got a tasting room here in the Columbus area. And every store, every grocery store sells it here. And it's excellent. BrewDog is also very good. They've got a couple hazy beers, but they also have a grapefruit IPA called Elvis Juice, and it's real good. Big fan.
Okay, I don't know about that grape juice beer. I've Not sure I've had one.
Grapefruit IPA. Grapefruit IPA, not grape juice.
I'm more of a M43 when it comes to the New England IPAs. Those are good.
That is excellent. And they have something Tweed something or other. Same brewery. I think that's the double.
I generally don't do the doubles. Like,
it's a bit much.
It's a bit much. So that's your beer. Spring session. We'll probably be back maybe even in a week for us or a month for a summer session. But it's good to talk beer, watches, other things on the podcast sometimes. So let's go to the mailbag. See here. We've got a letter first, just somebody writing in. We're going to riff on this. This is Mark from Lafayette, Indiana. Listens every week. He caught that we mentioned the Lincoln LS and the Blackwood a few episodes back. And he mentions that the truck, of course, was only for sale in the United States for one reason or 1 year. And for some reason, Mexico got it for a second year. I actually didn't know that. It's interesting. He mentions that the bed was carpeted. Do you remember that, Jeremy? The bed was carpeted.
In which truck now?
In the Lincoln Blackwood.
Yeah, it was like, it was kind of, well, was it carpeted? I was thinking it was like stainless, or maybe it's stainless on the sides and carpeted on the bottom. That's possible.
Yeah, so that was a thing. He also reminisces that the LS came with a V6 and had a V8 as an option. That's right. If you can find the V6, apparently it had a 5-speed manual. That's something I don't remember. The V8 was a 3.9 V8 from Jaguar, which was the same one that was in the Thunderbird. I do remember this. Mm-hmm. Some of those cars were actually better than you might remember. Like, there was like a minute there in the 2000s when some of the Lincolns and the Fords, that rear-wheel drive like platform that they both sort of dabbled in, they had some decent executions. Like, that Thunderbird was not bad. I don't mean the retro Thunderbird. I mean like that actual last Thunderbird they sold for a while. That was an okay car. That could be an underappreciated collector car. I mean, it was basically a Chevy Monte Carlo competitor, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
But personal to me, luxury coupe, right?
But the Thunderbird was rear-wheel drive, right?
I mean, that Thunderbird's rear-wheel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, give me that, you know.
So. Yeah. There could be a return of that segment. You know, we'll see. I just looked up just Blackwood info. We've got a computer sitting in front of us, so we may as well get the right info here. The sides of the bed were stainless, and they're like little locking compartments. And the bottom was carpeted. I'm seeing some pictures where there's like these stainless steel running strips that go over the carpet, and I'm seeing some without them. So maybe that was some sort of, you know, premium option package or something. But yeah, there was definitely carpeting in the bottom of the bed in a lot of these Blackwoods I'm seeing.
Thank you for writing, Mark. That's kind of a fun, we appreciate the riff just on a segment we had here. So let's spend some money.
Let's do it.
All right. This is Wayne from Portland, Oregon, looking to replace his wife's 2017 Jeep Wrangler Unlimited. Okay. In late March, they were rear-ended by a reckless driver. Total the Jeep. Oh, no. So her Jeep was actually, get this, set up with like a camping setup. There was a roof rack, tent storage in back. It was lifted. It was near perfect. So condolences. We're sorry to hear that. They did get a good settlement check from the insurance. And that's a tough decision. They want another camping type vehicle. Initial thought is another Wrangler, but there's some, you know, scar tissue from losing the Wrangler. So they're kind of wondering if, you know, they just basically say that's out. Okay. I would honestly probably say get another Wrangler, to be honest, given the setup, but they're looking to do something else. Criteria are manual transmission, four-wheel drive with low range, fun or unique color. Her old Wrangler was purple. Enough room for camping gear. The upper price limit is $50,000. They have a short list, which they didn't share, and that's okay, making us do some work here. So they're looking for basically a cool off-roader, $50,000. Kick it over to you. What do you think?
All right, so the Wrangler is the obvious choice. It meets all of their criteria, except that it's they literally said the wounds are too fresh, so that's out. I don't know if that also means that a Gladiator is out, but a Gladiator would also fit all the requirements quite nicely, and maybe even add a little bit of extra utility for all your camping gear with a truck bed. So obviously the Gladiator is an excellent option if a Wrangler's out. If you're willing to have a little bit of fun with it and make it a build, I've got two other options in order of difficulty slash outlandishness. First option, start with the Ford Ranger. It's an excellent platform. It meets your requirements, manual. Well, I don't think not a manual, so maybe it doesn't quite meet that requirement. But all the other ones, four-wheel drive with low, you know, it's got a ton of payload, which is the big problem with a lot of trucks like the Tacoma. They just don't have a lot of room for modifications, big wheels, tires, that kind of thing. It doesn't apply to the Ranger. If you don't like the idea of a Ranger and want something completely closed, you're going to have a really hard time with the manual transmission requirement. You can get an older 4Runner, but they haven't had manuals in them for a while now. Here's where I go way off the beaten path and say you could get a Volkswagen Vanagon Synchro.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's wild. Okay.
It's I mean, it's way off the beaten path here. But with your $50,000 upper price limit, you could get a pretty cool one. They are extremely capable. They will travel just kind of off-road scenarios that you would not expect. Very capable four-wheel drive system, manual transmission, definitely enough room for camping gear, meets your price range. You know, if you don't like the color, you can always paint it. So that's my off my rocker recommendation, VW Synchro. But really, if you're not willing to get a Wrangler, your best bet is probably a Gladiator.
I wouldn't disagree with that. I think, you know, it's worth noting the Gladiator is a very credible, like, mid-sized truck. It's not just a Gladiator with a bed, which I think is why they call it a Gladiator, not the Scrambler or, you know, any other names they could have gone with. I like the Gladiator. I'm more of a Wrangler guy myself. Just that's how I break down the segment. But I think that's a great choice. I was specking out Broncos right here, which I think is just, you know, a very obvious thing here. It would appear to fit everything they want. You could get a manual. It's a 7-speed manual. I mean, I would assume there's plenty of colors on the Bronco. Camping gear, upper price limit is 50 grand. Well, the Bronco, like the big Bronco, actually starts, you know, reasonably low. And the, like, let me see what this one is that I've specced out here. Where is it? It's well under 50 grand. Let me put it that way. Depending on the trim you get, you can, you know, get all the way up. I mean, even the base, which I almost can't believe, is 28.5. So I would steer you towards a Bronco, to be honest, just because, like, if you want an off-roader and you want to say, well, what's the closest thing to a Wrangler that's not a Wrangler? Well, it's a Bronco, the new one. They're not on sale yet, but you can certainly get on there and build and price and probably get pretty close to what you're looking for. You know, again, if you're looking for sort of like a Wrangler, well, then Gladiator. And then I do like the 4Runner option. I don't know how hard the manual transmission criteria is. If it's not, then maybe find a lightly used one or even a new one and away you go. The 4Runner is one of my favorite vehicles on the market. It really is. I think you get a little bit more vehicle around you than you do in the Wrangler. It just in general drives just so jouncy. I wouldn't say no. If you came to me and you were like, I'm thinking Gladiator, I would say, yes, get the Gladiator. If you're saying I like the 4Runner, I would say, well, here's some of the compromises. But if that's what you like, I like it too. Be aware of these, still get it. You know, it's almost like a little bit like, you know, when the doctor tells you, well, you can do this or you cannot do it. It's up to you. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, well, great, what do I do? That's how I would probably put this. You've got a lot of good choices. And since you've you know, you've got a bit of a budget here from the insurance company, you can give it a go. So,
yeah, you know, if the manual transmission isn't an absolute necessity, I've seen some amazing camper slash overlander build outs of the previous generation Lexus GX, the one that ended in 2009. Mm. That was, you know, it's the Land Cruiser Prado in a lot of the world, and it is got that same 4.7 liter V8 that we were talking about earlier. That is just like the pinnacle of vehicular reliability and durability. So that's a great choice if you're willing to bend that manual transmission rule. But you know what? I'm just going to stick with my guns and say you really have to get a VW Vanagon with the synchro. I mean, okay. I can think of nothing else that that is going to satiate your desire to have a really cool camping rig, you know, with some uniqueness, your manual transmission, your durable heavy duty four wheel drive system. So, I mean, don't buy it, but definitely buy it.
I would say Bronco, and I would probably say number two would be 4Runner. That's the way I would look at it. I suppose maybe you can find an old Land Cruiser just to try and complete the circle of this podcast, like a lightly used one that maybe was like in the $70,000 range. It's got some miles. I don't know. We're going too far afield here. Bronco, then 4Runner. That's all the time we have, Jeremy. It's not that close to happy hour, but hey, go have a beer if you want. I am going to have some more coffee. Send your questions about anything, mailbag, spend my money, whatever's on your mind, podcast@autoblog.com. He's Jeremy, I'm Greg. We'll see you next week.